Chapter 19. The sunset had flared out behind Beautiful Mountain when Chee's patrol car bounced over Lucy Sam's cattle guard and gained the pavement. In the darkening twilight, his headlights did little good, and Chee almost missed the unmarked turnoff. That put him on the dirt track that led southward toward Rolhai Rock, Table Mesa, and the infinity of empty country between these massive old buttes and the Chuska Range. Lucy Sam had told him, "Watch your odometer, and in about 8 miles from the turnoff place, you come to the top of a ridge, and you can see Mary Boy's place off to the left, maybe a mile." "It'll be dark," Chee said. "Is the turnoff marked?" "There's a little wash there and a big cottonwood where you turn," she said. "It's the only tree out there, and Mary Boy keeps a ghost light burning at his hogan. You can't miss it." "Okay," Chee said, wishing she hadn't added that "can't miss it" phrase. Those were the landmarks he always missed. "There's a couple of places with deep sand where you cross arroyos. If you're going too slow, you might get stuck, but it's a pretty good road in dry weather." Chee had been over this track a time or two when duty called and did not consider it pretty good. It was bad, too bad to warrant even one of those dim lines that were drawn on the official road map with an unimproved label and a footnoted warning. But Chee drove it a little faster than common sense dictated. He was excited. That boxy green vehicle must have been Hal Breedlove's boxy green Land Rover, the same car he'd seen at the Lazy Bee. One of those three men who climbed out of it must have been Breedlove. Why not suspect that one of the other two was the man who had called Breedlove at the Thunderbird Lodge 3 or 4 days later and lured him away from his wife to oblivion? He would get a description from Mary Boy if the old man could provide one. And he might be able to, because those who live lonely lives where fellow humans are scarce tend to remember strangers, especially those on the strange mission of risking their lives on Ship Rock. Whatever, he would learn all he could, and then he would call Leaphorn. For a reason he didn't even try to understand, sitting across a table from the legendary lieutenant and telling him all this seemed extremely important to Chee. He had thought he was angry at Leaphorn for signing up with John McDermott, but Leaphorn's clear black eyes would study him with approval. Leaphorn's dour expression would soften into a smile. Leaphorn would think a while, and then Leaphorn would tell him how this bit of information had solved a terrible puzzle. The odometer had clicked off almost exactly the 8 prescribed miles from the turnoff, and the track was topping the ridge. The moon was not yet up, but the ragged black shape of the Chuskas to the right and the flat-topped bulk of Table Mesa to the left were outlined against a sky adazzle with stars. Ahead, an ocean of darkness stretched toward the horizon. Then the track curved past a hummock of Mormon tea, and there shone the Mary Boy ghost light, punctuating the night with a bright yellow spot. She made the left turn past the cottonwood Lucy Sam had described into 2 sandy ruts separated by a grassy ridge. They led him along a shallow wash toward the light. The track dipped down a slope, and the bright spot became just a glow. He heard a thud from somewhere a long ways off, more like a sudden clapping sound, but he was too busy driving for the moment to wonder what caused it. The track had veered down the bank of the wash, tilting his police car. It entered a dense tangle of chaparral, converted by his headlights into a tunnel of brightness. He emerged from that. The ghost light was gone. Chee frowned, puzzled. He decided it must be just out of sight behind the screen of brush he was driving past. The track emerged from the brush into flat grassland, where nothing grew higher than the sage. Still no ghost light. Why not? Mary Boy had turned it off. What else? Or the bulb had burned out. Out here, Mary Boy wouldn't be on a Rural Electrification Administration power line. He'd be running a windmill generator and battery system. Perhaps the batteries had gone dead. Nonsense. And yet the only reason one puts out a ghost light is because, For some reason he believes he is threatened by the spirits of the dead. And if he believes that, why would he turn it off before Dawn Boy has restored harmony to the world? And why would he turn it off when he'd seen he had a visitor coming? Had Mary Boy been expecting someone he would want to hide from? Chee covered the last quarter mile slower than he would have had the light still been burning. His patrol car rolled past a plank stock pen with a loading ramp for cattle. His headlights reflected from the aluminum siding of a mobile home. Beyond it, he could see the remains of a truck with its back wheels removed. Beyond that, a fairly new pickup stood, and behind that, a small hogan, a small goat pen, a brush arbor, and two sheds. He parked a little further from the house than he would have normally, and left the motor running a bit longer. And when he turned off the ignition, he rolled down the window beside him and sat, listening. There was no light in the mobile home. Cold, dry December air poured through the truck window. It brought with it the smell of sage and dust, of dead leaves, of the goat pen. It brought the dead silence of a windless winter night. A dog emerged from one of the sheds, looking old, ragged, and tired. It limped toward his truck and stopped, the glare of his headlights reflecting from its eyes. Chee leaned out of the window toward it. "Anybody home?" he asked. The dog turned and limped back into the shed. Chee switched off the car lights and waited, uneasy, for some sign of life from the house. Tapped his fingers on the steering wheel. Listened. From somewhere far away, he heard the call of a burrowing owl hunting its prey. He thought, someone turned off that damned ghost light. Therefore, someone is here. I am absolutely not going back home and admit I came out here to talk to Mary Boy and was too afraid of the dark to get out of the car. Chee muttered an expletive, made sure that his official .38 caliber pistol was securely in its holster, took the flashlight from its rack, opened the car door, and got out. Thankful for the policy that eliminated those dome lights that went on when the door opened. He stood beside the car, glad of the darkness, and shouted, "Austin Mary Boy!" and a greeting in Navajo. He identified himself by clan and family. He waited. Only silence. But the sound of his own voice, loud and clear, had burst the bubble of his nervousness. He waited as long as politeness required, walked up to the entrance, climbed the two concrete block steps that led to the door, and tapped on the screen. Nothing. He tapped again, harder this time. Again, no response. He tried the screen, swung it open, tried the door. The knob turned easily in his hand. "Austin Mary Boy," Chee shouted. "You've got company." He listened. Nothing. And opened the door to total darkness. Flicked on his flash. If time is measurable in such circumstances, it might have taken a few nanoseconds for Chee's flashlight beam to traverse this tiny room from end to end and find it unoccupied. But even while this was happening, his peripheral vision was telling him otherwise. He turned the flashlight downward. The body lay on its back, feet toward the door, as if the man had come to answer a visitor's summons and then had been knocked directly backward. In the moment that elapsed before Chee snapped off the flash and jumped into the darkness of the house, he had reached several conclusions. The man had been shot near the center of the chest. He was probably, but not certainly, Mr. Merryboy. The clap-like sound he had heard had been the fatal shot. Thus, the shooter must be nearby. Having shot Mary Boy and seen Chee's headlights, he had switched off the ghost light. And, more to the immediate point, Acting Lieutenant Jim Chee was likely to get shot himself. He leaned against the wall beside the door, drew the pistol, cocked it, and made sure the safety was off. Chee spent the next few minutes listening to the silence and thinking his situation through. Among the aromas that came from Hosteen Maryboy's kitchen, he had picked up the acrid smell of burned gunpowder, confirming his guess that Maryboy had been shot only a few minutes ago. A frightening conclusion, it reinforced the evidence offered by the doused ghost light. The killer had not driven away. She would have met him on the access track. That he had walked away was possible, but not likely. It would have meant abandoning his vehicle. Was it the pickup he'd noticed? Perhaps. But that was most likely Maryboy's. The killer, having seen him coming, would have had plenty of time to move his car, but no way to drive out without meeting Chi on the track. So, what options did he have? Chi squatted beside the body, felt for a pulse, and found none. The man was dead. That reduced the urgency a little. He could wait for daylight, which would even the odds. As it now stood, the killer knew exactly where he was, and he didn't have a clue. But waiting had a downside, too. It would occur to the killer, sooner or later, to fire a shot into the patrol car gas tank, or do something else to disable it. Then he could drive away unpursued. Or he might drain out some gasoline from any one of the vehicles, set this mobile home ablaze, and shoot Chi as he came out. By now his eyes had adjusted to the darkness. Chi could easily see the windows. The starlight that came through them, dim as it was, allowed him to make out a chair, a couch, a table, and the door that led into the kitchen. Could the killer be there, or in the bedroom beyond it? Not likely. He sat against the wall, holding his breath, focusing every instinct on listening. He heard nothing. Still, he dreaded the thought of being shot in the back. Chi picked up the flash, held it far from his body, pointed both his pistol and the flash at the kitchen doorway, and flicked it on. Nothing moved in the part of the room visible to him. He edged to the door, keeping the flash away from him. The kitchen was empty. And so, when he repeated that process, were the bedroom and the tiny bath behind it. Back in the living room, Chi sat on the couch and made himself as comfortable as the circumstances permitted. He weighed the options, found no new ones, imagined dawn coming, imagined the sun rising, imagined waiting and waiting, imagined finally saying to hell with it and walking out to the patrol car. Then he would either be shot or he wouldn't be. If he wasn't shot, he would have to get on the radio and report this affair to Captain Largo. "When did this happen?" the captain would ask. And then, "Why did you wait all night to report it?" And then, "Are you telling me that you sat in the house all night because you were afraid to come out?" And the only answer to that would be, "Yes, sir, that's what I did." And then a little later, Janet Pete would be asking why he was being dismissed from the Navajo Tribal Police. And he would say, "But would Janet care enough to ask? And did it matter anyway?" Something mattered. Chi got up, stood beside the door, looking and listening, impressed with how bright the night now seemed outside the lightless living room. But he saw nothing and heard nothing. He pushed open the screen and, pistol in hand, dashed to the patrol car, pulled open the door and slid in, crouched low in the seat, grabbed the mic, started the engine. The night dispatcher responded almost instantly. "Have a homicide at the Maryboy place," Chi said. "With the perpetrator still in the area, I need..." The dispatcher remembered hearing the sound of two shots, closely spaced, and of breaking glass, and something she described as scratching, squeaking, and thumping. That was the end of the message from Acting Lieutenant Jim Chi.